girl, it seemed best to bring her here and get the business done with quickly.
And what business is that? Ned put ice in his voice. The Queen stepped forward. You know full well, Stark, this girl of yours attacked my son, her and her butcher's boy. That animal of hers tried to tear his arm off.
That's not true, Arya said loudly. She just bit him a little. He was hurting Micah.
Joff told us what happened, the Queen says. You and the butcher's boy beat him with clubs while you set your wolf on him.
That's not how it was, Arya said, close to tears.
Ned put a hand on her shoulder. Yes, it is, Prince Joffrey insisted. They all attacked me, and she threw Lion's Tooth in the river. Ned noticed that he did not so much as glance at Arya as he spoke.
Liar, Arya yelled.
Shut up, the prince yelled back. Enough, the king roared, rising from his seat, his voice thick with irritation. Silence fell. He glared at Arya through his thick beard.
Now, child, you will tell me what happened. Tell it all, and tell it true. It is a great crime to lie to a king.
Then he looked over at his son.
And when she is done, you will have your turn. Until then, hold your tongue.
As Arya began her story, Ned heard the door open behind him. He glanced back and saw Vaen Poole enter with Sansa. They stood quietly at the back of the hall as Arya spoke. When she got to the part where she threw Joffrey's sword in the middle of the trident, Renly Baratheon began to laugh. The king bristled.
Sir Barristan, escort my brother from the hall before he chokes.
Lord Renly stifled his laughter. My brother is too kind. I can find the door myself.
He bowed to Joffrey.
Perchance later you'll tell me how a 9-year-old girl, the size of a wet rat, managed to disarm you with a broom handle and throw your sword in the river.
As the door swung shut behind him, Ned heard him say,
Lion's Tooth, and guffaw once more.
Prince Joffrey was pale as he began his very different version of events. When his son was done talking, the king rose heavily from his seat, looking like a man who wanted to be anywhere but here.
What in all the seven elves am I supposed to make of this? He says one thing, she says another.
They were not the only ones present, Ned said. Sansa, come here. Ned had heard her version of the story the night Arya had vanished. He knew the truth. Tell us what happened. His eldest daughter stepped forward hesitantly. She was dressed in blue velvets trimmed with white, a silver chain around her neck. Her thick auburn hair had been brushed until it shone. She blinked at her sister, then at the young prince.
"I don't know," she said tearfully, looking as though she wanted to bolt. "I don't remember. Everything happened so fast I didn't see."
"You rotten!"
Arya shrieked. She flew at her sister like an arrow, knocking Sansa down to the ground, pummeling her.
Liar! 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 Liar!
Arya, stop it! Ned shouted. Jorah pulled her off her sister, kicking. Sansa was pale and shaking as Ned lifted her back to her feet. Are you hurt? He asked. But she was staring at Arya, and she did not seem to hear.
The girl is as wild as that filthy animal of hers, Cersei Lannister said.
Robert, I want her punished.
Seven elves, Robert swore. Cersei, look at her, she's a child. What will you have me do? Whip her through the streets? Damn it, Chiltern, fight! It's over. No lasting harm was done.
The queen was furious. Joff will carry those scars for the rest of his life. Robert Baratheon looked at his eldest son.
So he will. Perhaps they will teach him a lesson.
Ned, see that that daughter of yours is disciplined. I will do the same with my son.
Gladly, Your Grace, Ned said, with vast relief. Robert started to walk away, but the queen was not done.
And what of the dire wolf? She called after him. What of the beast that savaged your son?
The king stopped, turned back, frowned.
Oh, I'd forgotten about the damn wolf.
Ned could see Arya tense in Jorah's arms. Jorah spoke up quickly. "We've found no trace of the Dire Wolf, Your Grace." Robert did not look unhappy.
"No, so be it."
The Queen raised her voice. 100 golden dragons to the man who brings me its skin."
"A costly pelt," Robert grumbled. "I want no part of this woman. You can damn well buy your furs with Lannister gold."
The Queen regarded him coolly. "I had not thought you so niggardly. The king I'd thought to wed would have laid a wolfskin across my bed before the sun went down." Robert's face darkened with anger. "That would be a fine trick, without a wolf." "We have a wolf," Cersei Lannister said. Her voice was very quiet, but her green eyes shone with triumph. It took them all a moment to comprehend her words, but when they did, the king shrugged irritably.
"As you will. As Sir Ilyen say to it."
"Robert, you cannot mean this," Ned protested. The king was in no mood for more argument.
"Enough, Ned. I will hear no more. A dire wolf is a savage beast.
Sooner or later it would have turned on your girl the same way the other did on my son. Get her a dog. She'll be happier for it."
That was when Sansa finally seemed to comprehend. Her eyes were frightened as they went to her father.
He doesn't mean lady, does he?"
She saw the truth on his face.
"No," she said, "no, not lady. Lady didn't bite anybody. She's good."
"Lady wasn't there," Arya shouted, angry. "Leave her alone."
"Stop them," Sansa pleaded. "Don't let them do it, please. Please, it wasn't lady, it was Nymeria. Arya did it. You can't, it wasn't lady. Don't let them hurt lady. I'll make her be good, I promise, I promise."
She started to cry. All Ned could do was take her in his arms and hold her while she wept. He looked across the room at Robert, his old friend, closer than any brother. "Please, Robert, for the love you bear me, for the love you bore my sister, please." The king looked at them for a long moment, then turned his eyes on his wife.
"Damn you, Cersei," he said with loathing.
Ned stood, gently disengaging himself from Sansa's grasp. All the weariness of the past 4 days had returned to him. "Do it yourself, then, Robert," he said in a voice cold and sharp as steel. "At least have the courage to do it yourself." Robert looked at Ned with flat, dead eyes and left without a word, his footsteps heavy as lead. Silence filled the hall. "Where is the direwolf?" Cersei Lannister asked when her husband was gone. Beside her, Prince Joffrey was smiling. "The beast is chained up outside the gatehouse, Your Grace," Sir Barristan Selmy answered reluctantly. "Send for Ilyen Payne."
"No," Ned said.
"Jory, take the girls back to their rooms and bring me ice." The words tasted of bile in his throat, but he forced them out. "If it must be done, I will do it." Cersei Lannister regarded him suspiciously. "You, Stark? Is this some trick? Why would you do such a thing?" They were all staring at him, but it was Sansa's look that cut. "She is of the North. She deserves better than a butcher." He left the room with his eyes burning, and his daughter's wails echoing in his ears, and found the direwolf pup where they chained her. Ned sat beside her for a moment.
"Lady," he said, tasting the name. He had never paid much attention to the names the children had picked, but looking at her now, he knew that Sansa had chosen well. She was the smallest of the litter, the prettiest, the most gentle and trusting. She looked at him with bright golden eyes, and he ruffled her thick grey fur. Shortly, Jory brought him ice. When it was over, he said, "Choose 4 men and have them take the body north. Bury her at Winterfell.
"All that way?" Jorry said, astonished. "All that way," Ned affirmed. "The Lannister woman shall never have this skin." He was walking back to the tower to give himself up to sleep at last, when Sandor Clegane and his riders came pounding through the castle gates back from the hunt. There was something slung over the back of his destrier, a heavy shape wrapped in a bloody cloak. "No sign of your daughter, Hand," the hound rasped down. "But the Dane was not wholly wasted. We got her little pet." He reached back and shoved the burden off, and it fell with a thud in front of Ned. Bending, Ned pulled back the cloak, dreading the words he would have to find for Arya. But it was not Nymeria after all. It was the butcher's boy, Micah, his body covered in dried blood. He had been cut almost in half, from shoulder to waist, by some terrible blow struck from above.
"You rode him down?"
Ned said. The hound's eyes seemed to glitter through the steel of that hideous dog's head helm.
"He ran." He looked at Ned's face and laughed. "But not very fast."
Bran.
It seemed as though he had been falling for years. "Fly," a voice whispered in the darkness, but Bran did not know how to fly, so all he could do was fall. Maester Lewin made a little boy of clay, baked him until he was hard and brittle, dressed him in Bran's clothes, and flung him off a roof. Bran remembered the way he shattered. "But I never fall," he said, falling. The ground was so far below him he could barely make it out through the grey mist that whirled around him, but he could feel how fast he was falling, and he knew what was waiting for him down there. Even in dreams you could not fall forever. He would wake up in the instant before he hit the ground, he knew. You always wake up in the instant before you hit the ground.
"And if you don't?" the voice asked.
The ground was closer now. Still far, far away, 1,000 miles away, but closer than it had been. It was cold here in the darkness. There was no sun, no stars, only the ground below, coming up to smash him, and the grey mists and the whispering voice. He wanted to cry.
"Not cry. Fly."
"I can't fly," Bran said. "I can't, I can't."
"How do you know? Have you ever tried?"
The voice was high and thin. Bran looked around to see where it was coming from. A crow was spiraling down with him, just out of reach, following him as he fell. "Help me," he said.
"I'm trying," the crow replied. "Say, got any corn?"
Bran reached into his pocket as the darkness spun dizzily around him. When he pulled his hand out, golden kernels slid from between his fingers into the air. They fell with him. The crow landed on his hand and began to eat. "Are you really a crow?" Bran asked.
"Are you really fallen?"
the crow asked back.
"It's just a dream," Bran said.
"Is it?" asked the crow.
"I'll wake up when I hit the ground," Bran told the bird.
"You'll die when you hit the ground," the crow said.
It went back to eating corn. Bran looked down. He could see mountains now, their peaks white with snow, and the silver thread of rivers in dark woods. He closed his eyes and began to cry.
"That won't do any good," the crow said. "I told you. The answer is flying, not crying. How hard can it be? I'm doing it."
The crow took to the air and flapped around Bran's hand. "You have wings," Bran pointed out.
"Maybe you do, too."
Bran felt along his shoulders, groping for feathers.
"There are different kinds of wings," the crow said.
Bran was staring at his arms, his legs. He was so skinny, just skin stretched taut over bones. Had he always been so thin? He tried to remember. A face swam up to him out of the grey mist, shining with light, golden. "The things I do for love," it said. Bran screamed. The crow took to the air, cawing.
"Not that," it shrieked at him. "Forget that. You do not need it now. Put it aside. Put it away.
It landed on Bran's shoulder and pecked at him, and the shining gold face was gone. Bran was falling faster than ever. The grey mist howled around him as he plunged towards the earth below.
"What are you doing to me?" he asked the crow tearfully. "Teaching you how to fly."
"I can't fly."
"You're flying right now."
"I'm falling."
"Every flight begins with a fall," the crow said. "Look down."
I'm afraid."
"Look down."
Bran looked down and felt his insides turn to water. The ground was rushing up at him now. The whole world was spread out below him, a tapestry of white and brown and green. He could see everything so clearly that for a moment he forgot to be afraid. He could see the whole realm and everyone in it. He saw Winterfell as the eagles see it, the tall towers looking squat and stubby from above, the castle walls just lines in the dirt. He saw Maester Luin on his balcony, studying the sky through a polished bronze tube and frowning as he made notes in a book. He saw his brother Rob, taller and stronger than he remembered him, practicing swordplay in the yard with real steel in his hand. He saw Hodor, the simple giant from the stables, carrying an anvil to Micken's forge, hefting it onto his shoulder as easily as another man might heft a bale of hay. At the heart of the Godswood, the great white weirwood brooded over its reflection in the black pool, its leaves rustling in a chill wind. When it felt Bran watching, it lifted its eyes from the still waters and stared back at him knowingly. He looked east. He saw a galley racing across the waters of the Bight. He saw his mother sitting alone in a cabin, looking at a blood-stained knife on the table in front of her, as the rowers pulled at their oars, and Sir Roderick leaned across a rail, shaking and heaving. A storm was gathering ahead of them, a vast dark roaring, lashed by lightning, but somehow they could not see it. He looked south, and saw the great blue-green rush of the Trident. He saw his father pleading with the king, his face etched with grief. He saw Sansa crying herself to sleep at nights, and he saw Arya watching in silence and holding her secrets hard in her heart. There were shadows all around them. One shadow was dark as ash, with a terrible face of a hound. Another was armored like the sun, golden and beautiful. Over them both loomed a giant in armor made of stone. But when he opened his visor, there was nothing inside, but darkness and thick black blood. He lifted his eyes and saw clear across the narrow sea, to the free cities and the green Dothraki sea and beyond, to Vaes Dothrak under its mountain, to the fabled lands of the Jade Sea, to Ashai by the shadow, where dragons stirred beneath the sunrise. Finally he looked north. He saw the wall, shining like blue crystal, and his bastard brother John sleeping alone in a cold bed, his skin growing pale and hard as a memory of all warmth fled from him. And he looked past the wall, past endless forests cloaked in snow, past the frozen shore and the great blue-white rivers of ice and the dead plains where nothing grew or lived. North and north and north he looked, to the curtain of light at the end of the world, and then beyond that curtain. He looked deep into the heart of winter, and then he cried out, afraid, and the heat of his tears burned on his cheeks.
"Now you know," the crow whispered, as it sat on his shoulder. "Now you know why you must live."
"Why?" Bran said, not understanding, falling, falling.
"Because winter is coming."
Bran looked at the crow on his shoulder, and the crow looked back. It had three eyes, and the third eye was full of a terrible knowledge. Bran looked down. There was nothing below him now but snow and cold and death. A frozen wasteland where jagged blue-white spires of ice waited to embrace him. They flew up at him like spears. He saw the bones of a thousand other dreamers impaled upon their points. He was desperately afraid. "Can a man still be brave if he's afraid?" he heard his own voice saying, small and far away. And his father's voice replied to him, "That's the only time a man can be brave."
"How, Pran?" the crow urged. "Choose, fly or die."
Death reached for him, screaming. Bran spread his arms and flew. Wings unseen drank the wind and filled and pulled him upward. The terrible needles of ice receded below him. The sky opened up above. Bran soared. It was better than climbing. It was better than anything. The world grew small beneath him. "I'm flying!" he cried out in delight.
"I've noticed," said the three-eyed crow.
It took to the air, flapping its wings in his face, slowing him, blinding him. He faltered in the air as its pinions beat against his cheeks. Its beak stabbed at him fiercely, and Bran felt a sudden blinding pain in the middle of his forehead, between his eyes. "What are you doing?" he shrieked. The crow opened his beak and cawed at him, a shrill scream of fear, and the grey mist shuddered and swirled around him and ripped away like a veil, and he saw that the crow was really a woman, a serving woman, with long black hair. And he remembered her from somewhere, from Winterfell. Yes, that was it. He remembered her now. And then he realized that he was in Winterfell, in a bed high in some chilly tower room, and the black-haired woman dropped a basin of water to shatter on the floor and ran down the steps shouting, "He's awake! He's awake! He's awake!" Bran touched his forehead between his eyes. The place where the crow had pecked him was still burning, but there was nothing there, no blood, no wound. He felt weak and dizzy. He tried to get out of bed, but nothing happened. And then there was movement beside the bed, and something landed lightly on his legs. He felt nothing. A pair of yellow eyes looked into his own, shining like the sun. The window was open, and it was cold in the room, but the warmth that came off the wolf enfolded him like a hot bath. His pup, Bran realized. Or was it? He was so big now. He reached out to pet him, his hand trembling like a leaf. When his brother Rob burst into the room, breathless from his dash up the tower steps, the direwolf was licking Bran's face. Bran looked up calmly.
"His name is Summer," he said.
Catelyn.
"We will make King's Landing within the hour."
Catelyn turned away from the rail and forced herself to smile. "Your Ormen have done well by us, Captain. Each one of them shall have a silver stag as a token of my gratitude." Captain Mario Chumitis favoured her with a half bow.
"You're far too generous, Lady Stark. The honour of carrying a great lady like yourself is all the reward they need."
"But they'll take the silver anyway." Mario smiled.
"As you say."
He spoke the common tongue fluently, with only the slightest hint of a Tyrushi accent. He'd been plying the narrow sea for 30 years, he told her, as oarman, quartermaster, and finally captain of his own trading galleys. The Storm Dancer was his fourth ship, and his fastest, a 2-masted galley of 60 oars. She had certainly been the fastest of the ships available in White Harbour when Catelyn and Sir Roderick Cassell had arrived after their headlong gallop down river. The Tyrushi were notorious for their avarice, and Sir Roderick had argued for hiring a fishing sloop out of the Three Sisters, but Catelyn had insisted on the galley. It was good that she had. The winds had been against them much of the voyage, and without the galley's oars, they'd still be beating their way past the Fingers, instead of skimming towards King's Landing and Journey's End. So close, she thought. Beneath the linen bandages, her finger still throbbed where the dagger had bitten. The pain was her scourge, Catelyn felt, lest she forget. She could not bend the last two fingers of her left hand, and the others would never again be dexterous. Yet that was a small enough price to pay for Bran's life. Sir Roderick chose that moment to appear on deck.
"My good friend," said Maria through his forked green beard. The Tyroshi loved bright colors, even in their facial hair. "It's so fine to see you looking better."
"Yes," Sir Roderick agreed. "I haven't wanted to die for almost 2 days now." He bowed to Catelyn. "My lady?" He was looking better. A shade thinner than he had been when they set out from White Harbor, but almost himself again. The strong winds in the bight and the roughness of the narrow sea had not agreed with him, and he'd almost gone over the side when the storm seized them unexpectedly off Dragonstone. Yet somehow he had clung to a rope until three of Maria's men could rescue him and carry him safely below decks. "The captain was just telling me that our voyage is almost at an end," she said. Sir Roderick managed a wry smile. "So soon?" He looked odd without his great white side whiskers. Smaller somehow, less fierce, and 10 years older. Yet back on the bight, it had seemed prudent to submit to a crewman's razor, after his whiskers had become hopelessly befouled for the third time, while he leaned over the rail and retched into the swirling winds.
"I will leave you to discuss your business," Captain Morio said.
He bowed and took his leave of them. The galley skimmed the water like a dragonfly, her oars rising and falling in perfect time. Sir Roderick held the rail and looked out over the passing shore.
"I have not been the most valiant of protectors."
Catelyn touched his arm. "We are here, Sir Roderick, and safely. That is all that truly matters." Her hand groped beneath her cloak, her fingers stiff and fumbling. The dagger was still at her side. She found she had to touch it now and then to reassure herself. "Now we must reach the king's master-at-arms and pray he can be trusted." "Sir Aaron Santagar is a vain man, but an honest one." Sir Roderick's hand went to his face and stroked his whiskers, and discovered once again they were gone. He looked nonplussed.
"He may know the blade, yes, but, my lady, the moment we go ashore we are at risk, and there are those at court who will know you on sight."
Catelyn's mouth grew tight. "Littlefinger," she murmured. His face swam up before her, a boy's face, though he was a boy no longer. His father had died several years before, so he was Lord Baelish now. Yet still they called him Littlefinger. Her brother Edmure had given him that name long ago at Riveron. His family's modest holdings were on the smallest of the fingers, and Petar had been slight and short for his age. Sir Roderick cleared his throat.
"Lord Baelish once,
His thought trailed off uncertainly in a search of the polite word. Catelyn was past delicacy. "He was my father's ward. We grew up together in Riveron. I thought of him as a brother, but his feelings for me were more than brotherly. When it was announced that I was to wed Brandon Stark, Petaia challenged for the right to my hand. It was madness. Brandon was 20. Petaia scarcely 15. I had to beg Brandon to spare Petaia's life. He let him off with a scar. Afterward, my father sent him away. I have not seen him since." She lifted her face to the spray, as if the brisk wind could blow the memories away. "He wrote to me at River Run after Brandon was killed, but I burned the letter unread. By then I knew that Ned would marry me in his brother's place." Sir Roderick's fingers fumbled once again for non-existent whiskers.
"Littlefinger sits on the small council now."
"Well, I knew he would rise high," Catelyn said. "He was always clever, even as a boy. But it's one thing to be clever and another to be wise. I wonder what the years have done to him." High overhead, the far eye sang out from the rigging.
Captain Murillo came scrambling across the deck, giving orders, and all around them the Storm Dancer burst into frenetic activity as King's Landing slid into view atop three high hills. 300 years ago, Caitlin knew, those heights had been covered with forest, and only a handful of fisherfolk had lived on the north shore of the Blackwater Rush, where that deep, swift river flowed into the sea. Then Aegon the Conqueror had sailed from Dragonstone. It was here that his army had put ashore, and there, on the highest hill, that he built his first crude redoubt of wood and earth. Now the city covered the shore as far as Catalan could see. Manses and arbors and granaries, brick storehouses and timbered inns and merchant stalls, taverns and graveyards and brothels all piled one on another. She could hear the clamor of the fish market even at this distance. Between the buildings were broad roads lined with trees, wandering crookback streets, and alleys so narrow that two men could not walk abreast. Visenya's hill was crowned by the great sept of Baelor with its seven crystal towers. Across the city on the hill of Rhaenys stood the blackened wall of the Dragon Pit, its huge dome collapsing into ruin, its bronze doors closed now for a century. The Street of the Sisters ran between them, straight as an arrow. The city walls rose in the distance, high and strong. 100 quays lined the waterfront, and the harbour was crowded with ships. Deep-water fishing boats and river runners came and went. Ferrymen poled back and forth across the Blackwater Rush. Trading galleys unloaded goods from Braavos and Pentos and Lice. Catelyn spied the Queen's ornate barge tied up beside a fat-bellied whaler from the port of Ibbon, its hull black with tar, while upriver a dozen lean golden warships rested in their cribs, sails furled, and cruel iron rams lapping at the water. And above it all, frowning down from Aegon's high hill, was a red keep. Seven huge drum towers crowned with iron ramparts, an immense grim barbican, vaulted halls and covered bridges, barracks and dungeons and granaries, massive curtained walls studded with archers' nests, all fashioned of pale red stone. Aegon the Conqueror had commanded it built. His son, Maegor the Cruel, had seen it completed. Afterwards he had taken the heads of every stonemason, woodworker, and builder who had labored on it. Only the blood of the dragon would ever know the secrets of the fortress the dragon lords had built, he vowed. Yet now the banners that flew from its battlements were golden, not black, and where the three-headed dragon had once breathed fire, now pranced the crown stag of House Baratheon. A high-masted swan ship from the Summer Isles was beating out from port, its white sails huge with wind. The Storm Dancer moved past it, pulling steadily for shore. "My lady," Sir Roderick said, "I have thought on how best to proceed while I lay abed. You must not enter the castle. I will go in your stead, and bring Sir Aaron to you in some safe place." She studied the old knight as the galley drew near to appear. Murillo was shouting in the vulgar Valyrian of the free cities, "You be as much at risk as I would." Sir Roderick smiled. "I think not. I looked at my reflection in the water earlier and scarcely recognized myself. My mother was the last person to see me without whiskers, and she is 40 years dead. I believe I am safe enough, my lady." Maria bellowed a command. As one, 60 oars lifted from the river, then reversed and backed water. The galley slowed. Another shout. The oars slipped back inside the hull. As they thumped against the dock, Tyroshi seamen leapt down to tie up. Murillo came bustling up all smiles. "King's Landing, my lady, as you did command,
and never has a ship made a swifter or shorter passage. Will you be needing assistance to carry your things to the castle?"
"We shall not be going to the castle. Perhaps you can suggest an inn, some place clean and comfortable, and not too far from the river." The Tairoshi fingered his fork green beard.
"Just so. I know of several establishments that might suit your needs. Yet first, if I may be so bold, there is the matter of the second half of the payment we agreed upon, and of course the extra silver you were so kind as to promise. 60 stags, I believe it was."
"For the oarman," Catelyn reminded him.
"Oh, of a certainty," said Mario, "though perhaps I should hold it for them until we return to Tairosh, for the sake of their wives and children. If you give them the silver ear, my lady, they will dice it away, or spend it all for a night's pleasure."
"There are worse things to spend money on," Sir Roderick put in. "Winter is coming."
"A man must make his own choices," Catelyn said. "They earn the silver. How they spend it is no concern of mine."
"As you say, my lady," Mario replied, bowing and smiling.
Just to be sure, Catelyn paid the oarman herself, a stag to each man, and a copper to the two men who carried their chests halfway up Visenya's hill to the inn that Mario had suggested. It was a rambling old place on Eel Alley. The woman who owned it was a sour crone, with a wandering eye, who looked them over suspiciously and bit the coin that Catelyn offered her to make sure it was real. Her rooms were large and airy, though, and Mario swore that her fish stew was the most savory in all the Seven Kingdoms. Best of all, she had no interest in their names.
"I think it's best if you stay away from the common room," Sir Roderick said, after they have settled in. "Even in a place like this, one never knows who may be watching."
He wore ringmail, dagger, and longsword under a dark cloak with a hood he could pull up over his head.
"I will be back before nightfall for Sir Aaron," he promised. "Rest now, my lady."
Catelyn was tired. The journey had been long and fatiguing, and she was no longer as young as she had been. Her windows opened on the alley and rooftops, with a view of the black water beyond. She watched Sir Roderick set off, striding briskly through the busy streets until he was lost in the crowds, then decided to take his advice. The bedding was stuffed with straw instead of feathers, but she had no trouble falling asleep. She woke to a pounding on her door. Catelyn sat up sharply. Outside the window, the rooftops of King's Landing were red in the light of the setting sun. She had slept longer than she intended. A fist hammered at her door again, and a voice called out, "Open, in the name of the king!" "A moment," she called out. She wrapped herself in her cloak. The dagger was on the bedside table. She snatched it up before she unlatched the heavy wooden door. The men who pushed into the room wore the black ringmail and golden cloaks of the city watch. Their leader smiled at the dagger in her hand and said, "No need for that, milady. We're to escort you to the castle." "By whose authority?" she asked. He showed her a ribbon. Catelyn felt her breath catch in her throat. The seal was a mockingbird in grey wax. "Pataya," she said. "So soon? Something must have happened to Sir Roderick." She looked at the head guardsman. "Do you know who I am?"
"No, milady," he said. "My lord Littlefinger said only to bring you to him, and see that you were not mistreated."
Catelyn nodded. "You may wait outside while I dress." She bathed her hands in the basin and wrapped them in clean linen. Her fingers were thick and awkward as she struggled to lace up her bodice and knot a drab brown cloak about her neck. How could Littlefinger have known she was here? Sir Roderick would never have told him. Old he might be, but he was stubborn and loyal to a fault. Were they too late? Had the Lannisters reached King's Landing before her? No,
If that were true, Ned would be here too, and surely he would have come to her. How? Then she thought, Mario, the Tairoshi, knew who they were and where they were.
Damn him.
She hoped he'd gotten a good price for the information. They had brought a horse for her. The lamps were being lit along the streets as they set out, and Catelyn felt the eyes of the city on her as she rode, surrounded by the guard in their golden cloaks. When they reached the Red Keep, the portcullis was down and the great gates sealed for the night, but the castle windows were alive with flickering lights. The guardsmen left their mounts outside the walls and escorted her through a narrow postern door, then up endless steps to a tower. He was alone in the room, seated at a heavy wooden table, an oil lamp beside him as he wrote. When they ushered her inside, he set down his pen and looked at her. "Cat," he said quietly. "Why have I been brought here in this fashion?" He rose and gestured brusquely to the guards. "Leave us." The men departed. "You were not mistreated, I trust," he said after they had gone. "I gave firm instructions." He noticed her bandages. "Oh, your hands." Catelyn ignored the implied question. "I am not accustomed to being summoned like a serving wench," she said icily. "As a boy, you still knew the meaning of courtesy." "I've angered you, my lady. That was never my intent." He looked contrite. The look brought back vivid memories for Catelyn. He had been a sly child, but after his mischiefs, he always looked contrite. It was a gift he had. The years had not changed him much. Patar had been a small boy, and he had grown into a small man, an inch or two shorter than Catelyn, slender and quick, with the sharp features she remembered and the same laughing grey-green eyes. He had a little pointed chin beard now, and threads of silver in his dark hair, though he was still shy of 30. They went well with the silver mockingbird that fastened his cloak. Even as a child, he had always loved his silver. "How did you know I was in the city?" she asked him. "Lord Varys knows all," Pataya said with a sly smile. "He will be joining us shortly, but I wanted to see you alone first. It's been too long, Cat. How many years?" Catelyn ignored his familiarity. There were more important questions. "So it was the King's Spider who found me." Littlefinger winced. "You don't want to call him that. He's very sensitive. Comes of being a eunuch, I imagine. Nothing happens in the city without Varys knowing. Oftentimes, he knows about it before it happens. He has informants everywhere. His little birds, he calls them. One of his little birds heard about your visit. Thankfully, Varys came to me first." "Why you?" He shrugged. "Why not me? I'm master of coin, the king's own counsellor. Selmy and Lord Renly rode north to meet Robert, and Lord Stannis has gone to Dragonstone, leaving only Maester Pycelle and me. I was the obvious choice. I was ever a friend to your sister Lysa. Varys knows that."
"Does Varys know about—"
"Lord Varys knows everything, except why you're here." He lifted an eyebrow. "Why are you here?"
"A wife is allowed to yearn for her husband, and if a mother needs her daughter's clothes, who can tell her no?"
Littlefinger laughed. "Oh, very good, my lady, but please don't expect me to believe that. I know you too well. What were the Tully words again?"
Her throat was dry. "Family, duty, honour," she recited stiffly. He did know her too well.
"Family, duty, honour," he echoed, "all of which required you to remain in Winterfell, where our hand left you. No, my lady, something has happened. This sudden trip of yours bespeaks a certain urgency. I beg of you, let me help. Old sweet friends should never hesitate to rely upon each other." There was a soft knock on the door. "Enter," Littlefinger called out.
The man who stepped through the door was plump, perfumed, powdered, and as hairless as an egg. He wore a vest of woven gold thread over a loose gown of purple silk, and on his feet were pointed slippers of soft velvet.
"Lady Stark," he said, taking a hand in both of his, "to see you again after so many years is such a joy."
His flesh was soft and moist, and his breath smelled of lilacs.
"Oh, your poor hands. Have you burned yourself, sweet lady? The fingers are so delicate. Our good Maester Pycelle makes such a marvellous salve. Shall I send for a jar?"
Catelyn slid her fingers from his grasp. "I thank you, my lord, but my own Maester Lewin has already seen to my hurts."
Varys bobbed his head. "I was grievous sad to hear about your son, and him so young. The guards are cruel."
"On that we agree, Lord Varys," she said. The title was but a courtesy, due him as a council member. Varys was lord of nothing but the spiderweb, the master of none but his whisperers. The eunuch spread his soft hands.
"On more than that, I hope, sweet lady. I have great esteem for your husband, our new hand, and I know we do both love King Robert."
"Yes," she was forced to say, "for a certainty."
"Never has a king been so beloved as our Robert," quipped Littlefinger, he smiled slyly, "at least in Lord Varys' hearing."
"Good lady," Varys said with great solicitude, "there are men in the free cities with wondrous healing powers. Say only a word, and I will send for one for your dear Bran."
"Maester Lewin is doing all that can be done for Bran," she told him. She would not speak of Bran, not here, not with these men. She trusted Littlefinger only a little, and Varys not at all. She would not let them see her grief. "Lord Baelish tells me that I have you to thank for bringing me here." Varys giggled like a little girl.
"Yes, I suppose I am guilty. I hope you forgive me, kind lady."
He eased himself down into a seat and put his hands together.
"I wonder if we might trouble you to show us the dagger."
Catelyn Stark stared at the eunuch in stunned disbelief. He was a spider, she thought wildly, an enchanter, or worse. He knew things no one could possibly know, unless... "What have you done to Sir Roderick?" she demanded. Littlefinger was lost.
"I feel rather like the knight who arrives at the battle without his lance. What dagger are we talking about? Who is Sir Roderick?"
"Sir Roderick Cassell is master-at-arms at Winterfell," Varys informed him. "I assure you, Lady Stark, nothing at all has been done to the good knight. He did call here early this afternoon. He visited with Sir Aaron Santigar in the armory, and they talked of a certain dagger. About sunset they left the castle together and walked to that dreadful hovel where you were staying. They are still there, drinking in the common room, waiting for your return. Sir Roderick was very distressed to find you gone."
"How could you know all that?"
"Oh, the whisperings of little birds," Varys said, smiling. "I know things, sweet lady. That is the nature of my service." He shrugged. "You do have the dagger with you, yes?"
Catelyn pulled it out from beneath her cloak and threw it down on the table in front of him. "Here, perhaps your little birds will whisper the name of the man it belongs to."
Varys lifted the knife with exaggerated delicacy and ran a thumb along its edge.
Blood welled, and he let out a squeal and dropped the dagger back on the table.
"Careful," Catelyn told him. "It's sharp." "Nothing holds an edge like Valyrian steel," Littlefinger said, as Varys sucked at his bleeding thumb and looked at Catelyn with sullen admonition. Littlefinger hefted the knife lightly in his hand, testing the grip. He flipped it in the air, caught it again with his other hand. "Such sweet balance. You want to find the owner. Is that the reason for this visit?"
"You have no need of Sir Aaron for that, my lady. should have come to me. And if I had, she said, what would you have told me?
I would have told you that there was only one knife like this at King's Landing.
He grasped the blade between thumb and forefinger, drew it back over his shoulder, and threw it across the room with a practiced flick of his wrist. It struck the door and buried itself deep in the oak, quivering. It's mine.
Yours?
It made no sense. Pattaya had not been at Winterfell.
Until the tourney on Prince Joffrey's name day, he said, crossing the room to wrench the dagger from the wood, I backed Sir Jamie in the jousting, along with half the court.
Pattaya's sheepish grin made him look half a boy again.
When Loras Tyrell unhorsed him, many of us became a trifle poorer. Sir Jamie lost 100 golden dragons. The Queen lost an emerald pendant, and I lost my knife. Her Grace got the emerald back, but the winner kept the rest.
Who? Catelyn demanded, her mouth dry with fear. Her fingers ached with remembered pain.
The imp, said Littlefinger, as Lord Varys watched her face. Tyrion Lannister.
John. The courtyard rang to the sound of swords. On the black wall, boiled leather and mail, sweat trickled icily down John's chest as he pressed the attack. Gren stumbled backward, defending himself clumsily. When he raised his sword, John went underneath it with a sweeping blow that crunched against the back of the other boy's leg and sent him staggering. Gren's downcut was answered by an overhand that dented his helm. When he tried a side-swing, John swept aside his blade and slammed a mailed forearm into his chest. Gren lost his footing and sat down hard in the snow. John knocked his sword from his fingers with a slash to his wrist that brought a cry of pain.
Enough!
Sir Alistair Thorne had a voice with an edge like Valyrian steel. Gren cradled his hand.
A bastard broke my wrist.
A bastard hamstrung you, opened your empty skull, and cut off your hand. Or would have, if these blades had an edge. It's fortunate for you that the watch needs stable boys as well as rangers.
Sir Alistair gestured at Geron and Toad.
Get the Aurex to his feet. He has funeral arrangements to make.
John took off his helm as the other boys were pulling Gren to his feet. The frosty morning air felt good on his face. He leaned on his sword, drew a deep breath, and allowed himself a moment to savour the victory.
"That is a long sword, not no man's cane," Sir Alistair said sharply. "Are your legs hurting, Lord Snow?"
John hated that name, a mockery that Sir Alistair had hung on him the first day he came to practice. The boys had picked it up, and now he heard it everywhere. He slid the longsword back into its scabbard.
No,
he replied. Thorne strode towards him, crisp black leather whispering faintly as he moved. He was a compact man of 50 years, spare and hard, with grey in his black hair, and eyes like chips of onyx.
The truth now, he commanded.
I'm tired, John admitted. His arm burnt from the weight of the longsword, and he was starting to feel his bruises now the fight was done.
What you are is weak.
I won.
No, the Oryx lost.
One of the other boys sniggered. John knew better than to reply. He had beaten everyone that Sir Alistair had sent against him, yet it gained him nothing. The master-at-arms served up only derision. Thorne hated him, John had decided. Of course he hated the other boys even worse.
That will be all, Thorne told them. I can only stomach so much ineptitude in any one day. If the others ever come for us, I pray they have archers, because you lot are fit for nothing more than arrow fodder.
John followed the rest back to the armory, walking alone. He often walked alone here. There were almost 20 in the group he trained with, yet not one he could call a friend. Most were 2 or 3 years his senior,
yet not one was half the fighter Rob had been at 14. Darien was quick, but afraid of being hit. Pip used his sword like a dagger. Jeren was weak as a girl. Gren, slow and clumsy. Holder's blows were brutally hard, but he ran right into your attacks. The more time he spent with them, the more John despised them. Inside, John hung sword and scabbard from a hook in the stone wall, ignoring the others around him. Methodically, he began to strip off his mail, leather, and sweat-soaked woolens. Chunks of coal burned in iron braziers at either end of the long room, but John found himself shivering. The chill was always with him here. In a few years, he would forget what it felt like to be warm. The weariness came on him suddenly as he donned the rough-spun blacks that were their everyday wear. He sat on a bench, his fingers fumbling with the fastenings of his cloak. So cold, he thought, remembering the warm halls of Winterfell, where the hot waters ran through the walls like blood through a man's body. There was scant warmth to be found in Castle Black. The walls were cold here, and the people colder. No one had told him the Night's Watch would be like this, no one except Tyrion Lannister. The dwarf had given him the truth on the road north, but by then it had been too late. John wondered if his father had known what the war would be like. He must have, he thought. That only made it hurt the worse. Even his uncle had abandoned him in this cold place at the end of the world. Up here, the genial Benjen Stark he had known became a different person. He was a first ranger, and he spent his days and nights with Lord Commander Mormont and Maester Aemon and the other high officers, while John was given over to the less than tender charge of Sir Alistair Thorne. 3 days after their arrival, John had heard that Benjen Stark was to lead a half-dozen men on a ranging into the Haunted Forest. That night he sought out his uncle in the great timbered common hall and pleaded to go with him. Benjen refused him curtly. "This is not Winterfell," he told him, as he cut his meat with fork and dagger. "On the wall, a man gets only what he earns. You're no ranger, John, only a green boy with a smell of summer still on you." Stupidly, John argued. "I'll be 15 on my name day," he said, "almost a man grown." Benjen Stark frowned. "A boy you are, and a boy you'll remain until Sir Alistair says you're fit to be a man of the Night's Watch. If you thought your Stark blood would win you easy favours, you were wrong. We put aside our old families when we swear our vows. Your father will always have a place in my heart, but these are my brothers now." He gestured with his dagger at the men around him, all the hard, cold men in black. John rose at dawn the next day to watch his uncle leave. One of his rangers, a big, ugly man, sang a bawdy song as he saddled his garron, his breath steaming in the cold morning air. Ben Stark smiled at that, but he had no smile for his nephew. "How often must I tell you no, John? We'll speak when I return." As he watched his uncle lead his horse into the tunnel, John had remembered the things that Tyrion Lannister told him on the King's Road, and in his mind's eye he saw Ben Stark lying dead, his blood red on the snow. The thought made him sick. What was he becoming? Afterwards he sought out Ghost in the loneliness of his cell and buried his face in his thick white fur. If he must be alone, he would make solitude his armour. Castle Black had no godswood, only a small sept and a drunken septon. But John could not find it in him to pray to any gods, old or new. If they were real, he thought, they were as cruel and implacable as winter. He missed his true brothers, little Rickon, bright eyes shining as he begged for a sweet. Rob, his rival and best friend and constant companion. Bran, stubborn and curious, always wanting to follow and join in whatever John and Rob were doing. He missed the girls, too, even Sansa, who never called him anything but my half-brother, since she was old enough to understand what bastard meant. And Arya.
He missed her even more than Rob. Skinny little thing that she was, all scraped knees and tangled hair and torn clothes, so fierce and willful. Arya never seemed to fit no more than he had. Yet she could always make John smile. He would give anything to be with her now, to muss up her hair once more, and watch her make a face, to hear her.